we inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio Network. I'm Walker Wildman, and it is good to be with you today on the program. We'll have Chris Woodward in with us in the last segment, as we do most Fridays. He'll be bringing us the news from American Family News. And if you get tired of reading CNN and MSNBC and all of these major media conglomerates that are all left-leaning, then American Family News is the place to go. AFN.net's that URL. AFN.net is the URL. Psalm 141 is where we are this week. This is the Psalm of David, reading a few verses in here. O Lord, I call upon you, hasten to me. Give ear to my voice when I call to you. May my prayer be counted as incense before you, the lifting up of my hands as the evening offering. That's verses 1 and 2. And that's what I've been pointing out as we read this passage this week, is that the writer here is describing the prayer, his prayer, as being an incense before the Lord and counted as an offering before the Lord. And it's an important aspect of prayer. Yes, as part of our prayer, part of our prayer is, of course, petitioning the Lord, making your request known to the Lord. But also another part, a critical element of prayer that must not be forgotten, is the fact that we are praising our Heavenly Father. We are recognizing His goodness, His power, His sufficiency, and His authority in our lives. That should be part of our prayer as well. And so our prayer should be a blessing, should be pleasing before the Lord. They should be an offering before the Lord. Our prayers should not just be all about us and what we need and what we want. That's not genuine, true prayer. Prayer is more than just bringing our requests before the Lord. Prayer should be all-encompassing, including our worship and admiration of God. That should be a part of our prayer. So may our prayers be incense before the Lord. That's Psalm 141, verses 1 and 2. Well, Culture Warrior, Don Wildman and the Battle for Decency, it's been out and publicly available for a little over a month now. And this is a great kind of year-end gift. You know, if you order today, we'll probably get it to you before Christmas, but maybe not, depending on the post office, the postal service, which is an absolute dumpster fire along with the rest of our federal government. But nonetheless, culturewarrior.movies URL, we'll send you the kit. We have a bookmark. We have my grandfather's book. We have the commemorative issue of the magazine and the DVD set. So if you go over to culturewarrior.movie, you can watch the full film there. And you can watch the full film at culturewarrior.movie, but if you want the physical DVD, some people like to put their hands on it, the DVD and the full kit, you can donate there at culturewarrior.movie before or after watching the full film, and we'll send you that full kit. So it's an excellent, excellent resource. It tells the full story of Don Wildman and AFA and about how you, one person, can make a difference. So let's listen to that trailer.
Here in the Christmas season of 1976, I sat down one night to watch television.
As we started looking for something to watch, every channel had something inappropriate on it.
There was nothing good.
I became angry that night. I left the parish ministry and founded the National Federation for Decency.
And I remember people going, "You're going to do what now, exactly?"
Reverend Wildman.
Reverend Wildman.
The Reverend Donald Wildman.
Reverend Wildman says the show is too sexually suggestive.
We monitored television to see who was sponsoring the offensive shows.
It was totally covered from the networks to the advertisers.
Well, at first they wanted to ignore it, but then after a while they couldn't.
NBC said the boycott is an obvious attempt at intimidation, and we will let the people judge the fairness of this tactic.
I'd like to know what right you think you have to tell me what to watch on TV.
Send that question to the network, okay?
He used to say, well, let everybody think I'm dumb. Said, that's to my advantage.
You know who sells more pornography than anybody else in America? 7-Eleven, your friendly family convenience store.
He stepped on a whole lot of toes early on, and they thought, I think, that they could just crush him.
Don told me that, Ben, I've been sued by Penthouse and by Playboy.
Things were changing, and many people just sort of acclimated to it, and Don Wildman didn't.
The Last Temptation of Christ.
It was going to be a blasphemous movie about the life of Jesus.
We're not talking about the specifics, we're talking about the general theme.
What you did with Brother Don as the leader, you got on and hung on as best you could.
AVA is funded in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts.
So it was just vile stuff that was being funded by the government.
If we lose this cultural war, we're going to have a hedonistic, humanistic society.
He was going to be faithful and lead the success up to God.
He's had an uncanny ability to look down the road and see the impact of things that are happening today.
I'm not trying to be a prophet of doom. I'm trying to be honest with you.
When you see people live out their faith, you know there's something to it.
One person can make a difference.
Well, there you have it. CultureWarrior.movie is that URL. CultureWarrior.movie is that URL. Culture Warrior Don Wildman and the Battle for Decency. Well, while we're talking about AFA projects, we can't fail to mention the Activate Summit 2025 coming up in June, the 12th through the 14th. We do have an early bird discount, 20% off going through the end of the year. Early bird 20 is that discount code when you go to check out. Early bird 20 is the discount code when you go to check out. If you want to call us, we'll be glad to give you that over the phone as well if for some reason you forget it or are having trouble registering. But if you go over to activate.afa.net, right there on the homepage, you can check out the summit, the Activate Summit 2025. It's the 12th through the 14th of June this upcoming summer. And I know that seems like forever away, but it'll be here right around the corner before you know it. You'll blink and we're in January. You'll blink again, we'll be in the spring. And you'll blink again and it'll be June. And not only registering early, which you get the 20% off right now at activate.afa.net, but this involves travel. If you don't live in North Mississippi, well, you're going to have to travel to be at our Activate Summit. And that involves booking a hotel and working out time off from work and scheduling things with the family. So there's a lot involved, with traveling with young families, which is, you know, at least half of our audience at a lot of these events. So go ahead and kind of get ahead of the schedule and don't procrastinate. Go over to activate.afa.net and right there on the homepage, you'll see the Activate Summit 2025. You can click Learn More. And the summit registration page will pop up and all the information about our speakers and our schedule and Activate Kids, which is 6 to 12, all of that's available at activate.afa.net. 174 days, 21 hours, 47 minutes, and 42 seconds until the Activate Summit starts. And the only way I know that is because I'm looking at the website and we have a countdown clock there. So that's how long we have until the summit. Look forward to seeing you there. We'll have a great time of fellowship and building one another up in the authority of Scripture. That's our biblical bedrock theme coming up this summer. Well, Congress, this continuing resolution, we're going to talk about it the rest of this segment and probably most of the next segment as well before we bring Chris in. But this continuing resolution that's being debated in Washington, D.C. is... I want to kind of give a little backgrounder here. So this is not a surprise that government funding is expiring this evening, on Friday evening. It's not a shock that at midnight, on technically midnight would be Saturday morning, but 11:59 p.m. on Friday evening, the 20th of December, 2024, government funding is expiring. And that's not a shock. That's not a surprise. Everybody knew this was coming. Why? Because several months ago, back in September, this deadline, this deadline was set back in September. So Congress has known that December 20th is coming and that the government has to be funded. And so the reason I state that, and that's for many people, that's obvious because you've kind of kept up with this. But the reason I state that is because the House of Representatives did not release the text of the 1,500-page spending bill until Wednesday of this week, like Wednesday afternoon to be exact. And that's a problem. That's a problem on multiple levels. The first reason it's a problem is because there's a 72-hour rule in the House of Representatives where they're supposed to have at least 3 days to read legislation before they have to vote on it. Well, if you do the math on that, Wednesday to Thursday, Thursday to Friday, that's under 72 hours. Well, under 72 hours could actually be close to 48 hours. Well, that's a violation of the House rules. So if you look at, that's point number one. Point number two is that why would you wait, right? If you've known about this since September, why would you wait until 48 hours before you have to pass a spending bill to present it? And it's 1,500 pages long. Like, why? What strategic advantage do you have in waiting until 2 days before the government funding expires? It just doesn't make sense. Well, then that leads us to the third point, and that is what I believe, and I believe this is cynical. I believe this is intentional. There's no other way to explain this other than intentionality, because this is not complex stuff. Look, there's all of the congressional staffers. There's all of the lawmakers. There's the Congressional Budget Office. There's all the special interest groups. Everybody knows how to put together these spending bills, and they can do it in pretty short order, all right? Even 1,500 pages can be put together pretty quickly by multiple congressional staff members and all the special interest groups and all the lobbyists, and they all meet in a room, and they can put these budgets. I mean, it's basically copy and paste, right? A lot of this stuff is existing funding or repeat funding. So there's no reason to wait until 2 days before the government runs out of funding to present this legislation. And so the only reason to do this is if you want to rush things and make people feel rushed and make it feel like an emergency. Because if the House of Representatives presented this legislation, I don't know, like weeks ago, they could really do it months ago. There's nothing complex about this stuff, folks. But the reason I believe that we don't get due time to examine what is in these spending packages is because the House of Representatives and the people that are authoring these legislation, they don't want to give people time to adequately read and consume and comprehend and digest what's in this legislation. That's the only way you can land this. There's no other way when you put all the pieces of the puzzle together. There's no other conclusion that you can land at other than the fact that Washington, D.C. thrives on chaos, procrastination, and last-minute deals. I mean, there's no other excuse under the sun as to why on earth we've known about this spending deadline since September, and we wait until December 17th, December 18th, to reveal the legislation. And you can say, well, they were negotiating. No, folks, no, this is not, there's not much negotiating going on here. I mean, basically, all these congressmen, they put in their requests for whatever pork they want in the bill, and they probably get it. All right. Not to mention, why do we need to negotiate about funding the government or not? Why do we have to turn every single opportunity to do basic functions like fund the operating expenses of the government, and we turn it into this bargaining chip on how much money my state can get? It's absolutely broken.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to our second segment of today's program. I'm Walker Wildman. Glad to be with you here on American Family Radio. The name of the show is At the Core. And we love our podcast subscribers. Everybody who is already subscribed to At the Core, we've got thousands of you already subscribed. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Please, just a reminder, those who are not subscribed, go to your podcast store, whether you're on Apple, Android, Spotify, whatever type of podcast platform you prefer. Just type in the name of the show, At the Core, and you can click the subscribe or the plus icon, and the latest program will be queued up in your podcast library. And it's completely free. There's no subscription cost. There's no gimmicks, no tricks. You don't have to key any information in. You just click the subscribe button, and the podcast will be queued up in your library. Well, let's jump to clips. To start out, let's kind of set this up with a Fox News report. This is a little over 2 minutes, but this is Chad Pergram reporting on Fox. He's been on Capitol Hill for several years, probably a couple of decades, and he's reporting on how House Speaker Mike Johnson had to scrap the spending bill after outrage was voiced by Elon Musk and various conservatives. Let's listen.
News in a big way. The House Speaker Mike Johnson has got his hands full on the Hill this morning, scrambling to figure out a plan B after a government spending bill collapses. President-elect Donald Trump, the Doge leaders, Elon Musk, Vivek Ramaswamy, all coming out against the what they call a pork-filled package, a Christmas tree in D.C. that runs more than 1,500 pages in length. Chad Pergram on Plan B now. Chad, good morning.
Bill, good morning. What's next is far from clear, but lawmakers must somehow solve this political Rubik's Cube or face a government shutdown. A conservative revolt incinerated the bill. House Speaker Mike Johnson scrapped the bill after Elon Musk said members who support the plan should be voted out. President-elect Trump and Vice President-elect Vance torched the bill.
We had a productive conversation. I'm not going to say anything else more about it tonight because we're in the middle of these negotiations, but I think we'll be able to solve some problems here, and we'll keep working on it.
Now, Vance met with Johnson at the Capitol last night. Mr. Trump never opposed the bill until the last minute. The incoming president now wants a debt ceiling increase attached to the bill. Conservatives are fuming.
It's a monstrosity. This is what we see year after year. This is why I ran for Congress to try to stop this practice. And it's frustrating. For the last 2 years, I've just had a front row seat to this reckless spending process. He could kick forward a very clean, streamlined CR that without all of these other things in it.
Now, including the debt ceiling complicates the bill geometrically. Many conservatives simply will not support any debt ceiling increase without cuts. One senior GOP source believes chances of a government shutdown are now 70%. Getting the votes to pass anything is now a challenge.
It's pretty crazy. I think what we've seen today is that the Speaker tried to get the votes and the necessary votes weren't there. And then we saw what happened on social media, and a lot of folks have, had second thoughts. Obviously, every time you change something, it's a challenge, right, trying to find the votes.
Now, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says Democrats will not bail out Republicans after reneging on the deal. President-elect Trump says Johnson will, quote, easily remain Speaker if he stays strong and avoids Democratic traps.
Well, there you have it. That's Chad Pergram on the Hill with Fox News. A couple thoughts here. Well, I got many, but just to keep it focused. This is really looking bad on Johnson. And I know a lot of people who know Mike Johnson personally. I think he's a good guy as far as his character goes, but his means of operating in this case is terrible. And here's why. President Trump won the election in a landslide. Considering the context and the division in America, it was a landslide. Considering how divided we are as a nation. And he did that over, let's see, over 5 weeks ago, like between 5 and 6 weeks ago, President Trump in November won in a landslide. Okay. So with that being said, why wasn't or was the Trump transition briefed on this bill well before this week. Like, why were they not in this process? And so this is where, if Mike Johnson's office did not include the Trump transition team on the terms of this agreement, then what on earth were they thinking? And if they did, then why is the Trump campaign, or the Trump transition, and President Trump himself acting surprised and shocked at this deal? See, this is where I'm confused. So you want to tell me that Mike Johnson and the congressional leadership in the House of Representatives, with Trump coming in let's see, almost a month, about a month out before the inauguration, you want to tell me that the Trump transition wasn't briefed and brought in on these negotiations? What on this earth are they doing? That's infuriating. And that appears to be the case, because otherwise, why would Trump and Musk and Vance and all the Trump team come out adamantly opposed to this deal if they were somehow in the negotiations? It just completely doesn't make sense. So you're left with the conclusion that they were not brought in on these discussions and negotiations beforehand, and they were left to deal with it in real time after the fact. The other thing is that the debt ceiling. Let's talk about the debt ceiling, because there's this debate about, do we increase it, do we not? I know conservatives traditionally have said we need to use the debt ceiling as a negotiating tactic to lower spending, and I understand that. But let me just explain to you practically how this works, so we're not confused. And I've been studying this stuff in Washington for over a decade, since my college days. And so I know all these games. I know all the games. I know how they all work. I know the talking points. I can tell you the talking points before they happen. I could have just told you that Chad Pergam with Fox News would have used the apocalyptic government shutdown at midnight terminology, because they do it all the time. I mean, this is like rinse and repeat. They do this stuff all the time. They make everything apocalyptic. The government's going to shut down and people are going to go hungry and their Social Security checks aren't going to go out. I mean, it's give me a break. So, and the apocalyptic stuff never happens. We had a government shutdown for over a month under Trump and nobody missed a beat. Nobody missed a meal. All right. Everybody was back paid. So, so on the debt ceiling increase, all right, here's what this is. All right, it's all a joke, and here's why. The same guys and gals that are signing off on the debt ceiling increase, twofold, they've already spent the money. Yes, I'm not making this up. The money, the vote on the debt ceiling increase is a vote to pay for bills that for dollars that have already been spent. Now, make that make sense. I don't even know how you can do that, but leave it to the government. Secondly, the same people that are signing off on the debt ceiling increase are the same people that are signing off on the spending. So it's redundant. It's absolutely, from a practical standpoint, the debt ceiling is dumb. The debt ceiling is redundant. The debt ceiling is a waste of time. And I know this sounds kind of unorthodox. It sounds counter-conservative to say that the debt ceiling, which sounds like a virtuous, noble thing, is dumb. But when you look at how it's practically exercised, it doesn't make sense. Now, if the debt ceiling was this, like, principled, immovable, etched in stone type thing, then it would make sense, right? It's kind of like the bank, the lender, telling you how much debt that you can assume based on your income and your risk, etc., and your assets. But in this case, there is no neutral, interested, responsible third party. It's the congressmen and the senators. They're the ones signing off on the debt ceiling increase. And it's on money already spent. So how are they not going to raise the debt ceiling? Do you see what I'm saying here? It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. The debt ceiling's always going to be increased. It's always going to be increased 100% of the time, and the reason for that is twofold. The money's already been spent, and the same people that are spending the money in the future are the ones signing off on the debt ceiling increase. Okay? So if you don't increase the debt ceiling, then the government literally can't print any more money, and how is that going to go? All right. So when President Trump says we need to increase the debt ceiling and conservatives are squawking about it, I kind of lean towards the President Trump side of things. Because the debt ceiling is being weaponized by the Democrats for negotiating purposes. But the debt ceiling, in fact, doesn't really mean much. It's just a weapon of Washington to leverage against Trump within 90 days of him taking the oath of office. So I think we need to ditch the debt ceiling altogether because it's symbolic. It's a waste of time. Congress controls the spending. If you want less spending, then Congress is welcome to induce less spending. If Congress wants to take on more spending and print more money, well, Congress can do that. That doesn't mean it's a wise decision, but do you see what I'm saying here? The debt ceiling is an absolute joke, and I don't know where on earth this came about. I know it was debated during the Obama era, but the debt ceiling is a joke, and that's why I'm not getting worked up about it. I actually am getting worked up about it because it's so ridiculous, but I'm not getting worked up in the sense that we've got to have the debt ceiling and we can't raise the debt. No, the money's been spent, my friends. Like, if you notice in Washington, when everybody gets worked up and the media makes a big deal about something, it's usually at the point in the deal where we can't do anything about it. Take note of that. If you'll notice, when the media makes a big deal about something, when Washington makes a big deal about something, and everything seems like it's consequential, that's usually at the point in the negotiations or the deal making or whatever where it's kind of the ship's already sailed. And the debt ceiling is Exhibit A. The money's already been spent, and the same ladies and gentlemen that are signing off on sending billions to Ukraine and billions here and billions there, well, they're the ones overseeing the spending and the debt ceiling increase simultaneously. All right. And we're at 37, approaching 37 trillion, I believe is the latest number, in debt. Let's see where we are exactly. Debt clock. We are at 36.2 trillion. Dollars in debt. So, and so when you put that in context, clearly we don't have a debt ceiling. To state the obvious, clearly we do not have a debt ceiling. That's another, all right, this is point number three. They're racking up. This is like an article. Maybe we can transcribe this. Point number three, clearly, we don't really have a debt ceiling because we're at $37 trillion. You can't take these people seriously. All right, so that's my rant about the continuing resolution and the debt ceiling. What do I think Washington should do? Well, good question. I think the first thing that needs to be done is to not thumb your nose in the face of the incoming president. I think the first thing that needs to be done is to not set President Trump up for failure, okay? And I think much of this continuing resolution would do that, and the debt ceiling lingering it over to President Trump's first few months in office. Because then Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries would leverage that for negotiations, and we would have to, you know, give them the kitchen sink, and it would be terrible. So, I think I don't know why, as far as what should be done, I don't know why the status quo can't be resumed, like continued, right? Whatever the government's doing right now, you just swap out the date, and instead of December 20th, you bump it out to March, all right? And you just continue the status quo of what's being done today, right now, because the funding that was done today, that is done right now, was passed back in September and got the majority of votes in both chambers. So why don't we just continue that? Instead of doing 1,500 pages, you can probably do it in much less pages than that and just do status quo. Let President Trump come in, and in March, President Trump and his team can renegotiate spending for the rest of the fiscal year. Also, if you noticed on the concessions side of the aisle, when it comes to concessions, it's always, and I mean always, the Democrats that get the vast majority of the concessions. I mean, they get billions in concessions. In the first term, President Trump had to scratch, claw, climb, fight over very little money for the wall. Very little money for the wall. And so we don't need to be afraid of a government shutdown. At the end of the day, if the Democrats want to go to the mat, let's go to the mat. Let's put on our stamina hat. Let's get in this thing for the long haul, and let's not be afraid of a government shutdown.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. Chris Woodward's with us. Welcome back, Chris.
Thank you very much.
All right, Chris is with American Family News. He's one of our reporters there. And Chris, we've got several topics that we can talk about today. I mainly want to keep things economically focused, mm-hmm. and we can tether that discussion to the border discussion, which the two are very much related, considering how much money America is spending on the illegal immigration crisis and how many jobs are being stolen by illegal immigrants. But before we do that, let's talk about these retail numbers, mm-hmm. Fed Powell, interest rates, housing market, etc.
Yes. Okay. So the headline about the retail sales for the month of November is retail sales came in, quote, better than expected. Not by much. Groups like Market Watch thought we would see 0.5%. We got 0.7%. So, yes, they came in, quote, better than expected. But it's not a gangbusters number.
Do you know if that's inflation adjusted? I would assume it is.
I think it is. Yeah. I think it is. Now, a couple of takeaways here. When you kind of delve into the numbers and figure out what really was selling and who was, you know, making some money in November, auto sales accounted for 1/5 of all retail sales. If automobiles were omitted, Market Watch says retail sales rose a more modest 0.2% last month. Meanwhile, in terms of who in retail is actually selling stuff outside of a car dealership, sales at internet retailers, another critical category, rose a robust 1.8% last month. So translation, that means in English, internet sales were driving retail sales.
Okay.
And, you know, there are small businesses that operate in the internet realm, but more or less it was probably people trying to save some money by getting it from a giant corporation, which has all kinds of bells and whistles to get it to you real quick. A couple of other things here. Restaurant sales fell 0.4% in November. Restaurant sales tend to rise when the economy is healthy and Americans feel secure in their jobs. They typically decline in periods of stress, which is a good segue into the inflation and other things.
Yes. So what I just got out of that headline, if we dissect the, if we only highlight the important numbers, basically retail sales are flat.
Yes.
I mean, pretty much.
Disappointing.
I mean, to 0.7 is like, I mean, come on. I mean, 0.5, 0.7, definitely within the margin of error, and nothing to brag about. That was I got a little kick out of the car price about the car sales making up one fifth of the retail sales because the car market is STUPID.
You really need to be in need of a vehicle right now. Yeah. And I feel your pain if
and
you
I
are
spelled it out
for
in the case there's little toddlers in the car and they don't, well, Walker said it's the S word. the cars, man, the inflation. Inflation hit a lot. It hit the grocery store shelves, but it hit the cars too.
Yes.
I see these cars. I mean, some of these cars are, I almost feel like I'm sinning by saying it, but some of these cars are like $70,000, $80,000, $90,000.
Yes. And
I'm not talking foreign made like Ferraris. I'm talking
correct.
Chevrolet stuff.
Yeah. Things that are made by blue collar, you know,
American made vehicles running $93,000 on the lot.
For anybody that has not had to go and look at lots like I had this year.
You got you a little minivan, don't you?
I do, yes. And the reason I got that is number one, the car I had prior to the van had some problems and I did not take as good a care of it as I should have, and I'm probably paying for that.
You gave
now.
It a run for its money, though.
I did.
The Volkswagen.
Now, used cars cost way more than they should, and that's a problem because used cars used to be the cheaper alternative when you were in need of a vehicle.
Yes.
It, Dave Ramsey, if you're listening, please forgive me, but I had to go out and get a new one because it actually made more economic sense in the long run with a lower interest rate getting the newer car than the 2018 model, which is insane.
Yes, that's right, because there's a trickle-down effect when the COVID manufacturing of new vehicles stopped, literally stopped. What would have been vehicles are not making it to the used car market. So, there's a lapse there. But, yeah, you're right. When you look at interest rates and you look at pricing, oftentimes buying new is the way to go. So that's a problem in and of itself, the insane price of vehicles. Surely, who knows if it'll come down or not. We'll just have to see. You got to have a lot of competition. You got to have a lot of production in order to get prices down. But on the economy, Chris, the Fed dropped rates by a quarter point. The market didn't like that, which I'm kind of not sure why the market didn't like it. Maybe the market didn't like when Powell said, yeah, we're probably only going to lower rates two times next year. I don't know how you can even project that.
Yeah.
But my point is that the economy's – I'm not going to say – we're not like in, 08 crash level like scenario. We're not in a good place. And Trump's, I know the stock market has been on fire, but the stock market and the economy are not necessarily the same thing.
No.
All right. If you've got investments and you got retirement, you're feeling good about that. But if you're going to the grocery store, you're not feeling good about that. All right. So Trump's got some work on his hands.
Yes.
Is my point.
Yeah. A carton of eggs does not care what my 401k looks like. A carton of eggs is going to cost what they dictate pretty much based on supply and demand. Yeah. It's a big problem. I think one of the things he is planning to fall back on is the fact that we are going to have a great and solid, reliable energy policy, which over the course of 2025, if we do things on day one, the day he enters office, by the end of 2025, we will have opened things up. We will have started exploration in certain places. We will have approved things, cut red tape, and all these things that are going to bring about an energy revolution, if you will. And I think he is banking on that, doing some things and how that's going to positively impact other policies that look to energy, the cost of energy, to kind of operate on. And I think that's what he's doing. So it would be a good thing if he and the Secretary of Energy, whoever it is, would come out and kind of explain that to people better than I just did in a word salad kind of an explanation.
Well, I think you're right. I think the moral of the story is that President Trump is going to make a huge difference. In due time, his policies are going to make a massive difference. And I think things are going to improve. I mean, things can really only improve from here when you look at where we are.
Can't get much worse.
But on the housing market, Chris, I know the Fed funds rate is not directly tethered to the mortgage rates, but they do similar trajectories
they
when you look at the historical trends. I was listening to a clip by David Bonson on Fox. He was on with Varney. The housing market is at a standstill. It's at an effective standstill. The reason is because we got high rates,
mm-hmm.
In the last 20 to 30 years, we have high rates, mortgage rates, and we have high prices,
mm-hmm.
all right? And those two things are a recipe for disaster. So people are just sitting still. They don't want to move. They don't want to build. They don't want to do anything because they're locked in at a 3%, 2.7% interest rate. And so that's another problem as well. Mm-hmm. That I don't know how much the White House can do about that, but I've heard the older generation say, well, I got a 20% interest rate back in the 80s. Well, you did, but the house was $50,000.
Right.
All right, and that same house is running $250,000 to $300,000 right now.
Yeah.
So, this current predicament is a predicament, and mm-hmm. I don't like when people dismiss it because the prices are insane.
Yes.
If you want to say, you know, you should be happy with a 7% mortgage rate, I agree with that when housing prices are normal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, $95, $100 a square foot, maybe $115 on the high end. But Chris, we're running $150, $170, and $190 square foot houses in Mississippi.
Yes, which is
five years ago, that's like California type pricing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some of the suburbs. So it's okay to have, you know, 5, 6, 7% mortgage rates. That's sustainable under normal house pricing environment.
Yes. There is a home in my neighborhood where I live, and it has been on the market for at least a year and a half. I want to say 2 years, and it's just sitting there. I've seen two or three different people looking at it on occasion. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not...
That means somebody can't budge on the price.
Right.
For whatever reason.
It's not... I'm trying to think of the fancy home in Asheville, North Carolina.
The Biltmore.
It's not the Biltmore, but it's not a shanty either. No one, and that's really a similar situation in the city of Tupelo, yeah. where we're sitting right now. I don't live in the city limits. For people that have never had the opportunity to visit the great state of Mississippi, there was a day where you could lay down a chunk of money and get a huge piece of land. You could build on it.
Yeah.
Still have some money left
decent
over.
Decent interest rate.
And now we're paying like Massachusetts prices for homes. And people can't do that in the state of Mississippi.
Yeah, that's right. That's going to have to be fixed. I don't know what that looks like, but either the rates are going to have to come down or the prices are going to have to come down or both. And supply is going to have to increase. One other thing that really is going to tether into the economic discussion is the deportation plan with President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reality is that the, you know, 30 million illegal immigrants that are in America, they have to have somewhere to live. And whether it's apartments or rentals or homes, they're using up housing. That's
yes.
a fact. All right. So let's listen to Tom Holman. Okay. When CNN tried to corner him on the number of deportations, he said, quote, "There is no limit." Clip 3.
I don't have a number. We want to arrest as many people as we can. They're in the country illegally, again, based on prioritization. We want to arrest every criminal, every gang member that's here illegally. That's a public safety threat. We want to arrest every fugitive, those who had due process at great taxpayer expense and have an order deportation but didn't leave and became a fugitive. We got over 1.5 million of those. And look, we got millions of people here illegally. I've said that if you're here illegally, you're not off the table. I mean, it's a violation of law. It's a crime to enter this country illegally. And after we give you
due
process...
But you don't have a number that you'd like to see
an immigration judge.
1 year from tonight, you don't have a number that you'd like to say, this many people have been deported on my watch.
No, I don't have a number. I want to arrest as many people as we can with the resources we have. We want to be the most efficient we can based on prioritization. There's no limit.
There you go. Quote, there's no limit. Mm-hmm. Chris, he didn't fall for the bait. But the mass deportation, I said it the other day, is only a mass deportation because Biden allowed a mass illegal immigration.
Yes, and the people that came here illegally. Like, but there's no accountability. It's always the people trying to fix the problem or the oppressors or the evil guys when you yourself broke the law.
This is going to help the economy, Chris. I'm not going to say it's going to be the driving factor, but mm-hmm. it's a portion of the discussion, and that is when you deport hundreds of thousands of illegal immigrants are over a million in the first year, those are jobs that Americans mm-hmm. ought to be working.
Yes. Yes. To go with that, Washington Times had a story out on this yesterday from here's the headline study. American men drop out of economy as immigrants claim jobs. This is research from the Center for Immigration Studies, and that points out that this is a problem, and American people are not taking American jobs because somebody that came into America illegally for whatever reason is now working in that job.
Yeah, this is going to help wages as well, because the illegal immigrants, obviously, they're getting paid very low wages because they're illegal. They literally have no leverage on their employer, and they're getting paid cash and on the side. And so you start deporting, Chris, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of illegal immigrants. This is a natural wage booster, and this is why we don't. I'm not a big fan of the unions. I understand their purpose and their role, and I think originally there was a place for them, but they've become this, you know, gang or this mob, basically, where, you know, they're like, we're not going to do anything unless you give us everything.
You can't get your packages until we get paid more.
And there's a problem with that. But when you let the system, the free market work itself out and you don't allow illegal immigrants to steal our jobs, then wages are naturally going to go up.
Yes.
Why? Because there's competition amongst companies and employers, and everybody wants to make sure that they can hire the best of the best people. So that's how the free market works itself out, and that's not even factoring in the union. So this is going to help wages.
Yes. Another thing that we desperately need in this country, too, is a better work ethic, because there are red-blooded Americans that have, you know, their families have been here for generations or centuries. And unfortunately, people, not just young people that always take the blame for this, but people in general just don't want to work anymore. That's why you've seen like agriculture groups say we need immigration reform so that way somebody can get out here and pick our sweet potatoes and our crops and things like that. Americans, unfortunately, whether it's a farm job or something at a desk in air-conditioned or heated rooms, they just don't want to work anymore. So when we fix this problem with immigration, we need to light a fire under some people and tell them, look, you need to get back and work for your country so your neighbor has things and your town can have more money, all these other things. And that will only help the problem that you said would benefit. I mean,
that is true. It is undoubtedly true that recent generations are not as work inclined and work prone to hard work as previous generations. But there's also a large fraction of young American men, which you covered that in that study, that have checked out of the workforce because they're getting offered laughable wages because the illegals are doing the work.
Very true. That's true.
So I think a lot of these people that are on the sidelines, these young men that are on the sidelines of the workforce, a lot of them will come back in when they can get offered competitive wages. I think that's a part of the equation as well. So, but undoubtedly, we've got to teach future generations how to work and not be afraid to work with your hands. There is absolutely zero shame with working with your hands. We've got to hammer that home. This whole, you know, theory that everybody's got to be a doctor or a lawyer is just insane. So we got to encourage hard work. We'll see you next time. Meet Kelsey. When she found out she was pregnant, she wasn't sure where to turn. But after meeting with the counselors at a preborn network clinic who loved and supported her, and after hearing her baby's heartbeat on a free ultrasound, she chose Life.
When a mother looks at her child through a sonogram, it does something to you. You know, I ended up deciding to keep my son, who is now 5 years old today. He's amazing. He brings absolute joy to my heart. I could not imagine life without him. Not only did they help me save his life, they saved my life.
By introducing a woman to her baby on ultrasound, a baby's chance of life doubles. If you have the means, would you consider a leadership gift to save babies in a big way? Your tax-deductible donation of $5,000 will sponsor Preborn's entire network for 24 hours, helping to rescue 200 babies. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 on your phone and then say the keyword baby. Or you can donate securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.